The day only has 24 hours. You only have two hands. So your ability to do anything at scale, or even not at scale, will depend on the quality of the people that you have around you. Whether they are the people who work with you, your bosses, your peers, and then on a broader sense, your customers, there's only very little that we can do by ourselves. And one of the trappings, one of the traps that people sometimes fall under is that when they get promoted, they feel that they should continue to do their old job plus the new job. And that's not the reason why they got promoted. They got promoted because somebody saw their talent and somebody saw that they could have an influence and an impact in the organization beyond what they can do with 24 hours.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Hernan Lopez is the co-founder and chairperson of Danvis. It's a startup bringing digital art into the real world through museum-quality LED displays. But previously, Lopez was a first mover in the emerging podcast industry, seeing the vision and opportunity long before many others. He was the founder and CEO of Wondery, a storytelling podcast network acquired by Amazon in 2021 for a reported $300 million. Wondery is best known for its immersive storytelling podcasts, including Dr. Death, Dirty John, American History Tellers, Business Wars, The Shrink Next Door, and Joe Exotic. Prior to founding Wondery, Hernan was president and CEO of Fox International Channels. He proudly chairs the Hernan Lopez Family Foundation, which is dedicated to helping address diversity in leadership. Hernan is also a founding governor of the Podcast Academy and a board member of the Latino Donor Collaborative. He holds an MBA from the University of Miami and lives in Los Angeles with his family. Hernan is a true success story for all immigrants. He didn't come to the United States until he was in his 20s. So I had to start the conversation by asking him about his childhood and what it was like growing up in Argentina.
Thank you for having me. As you know, I grew up in the suburbs of Buenos Aires. My dad was a store owner of auto parts, and my mom was an accountant. And we had a really good upbringing as it related to work ethics and the value of studying. And but my parents really wanted me to be in a traditional career. They wanted me to be a doctor, an engineer, and an accountant. And I said, I want to study advertising, which wasn't even a career, and or one of those careers that people expected you to have. So I was very fortunate that when I started college at night, I got a job during the day to work for a radio company that also owned a cable station, a cable operator. This is 30 years ago plus now in Argentina. And I wanted to be a copywriter. And they made me, they put me in the advertising and sales team. So from a very early age, I was able to connect with the creative side of my brain and the business side of my brain. I learned a lot of business from those early managers. And then a couple of years later, I moved to another company that also owned radio, but I came from the broadcast television world.
It's interesting, you know, when you think back and going back to those early days and talking about your father being an entrepreneur and your mom with the finance and accounting, are there things still with you today that you learned from them early on?
Oh, I learned probably all of my appreciation of finance and the business side. I came from both of them from different perspectives. Obviously, my mom on the bookkeeping side and my dad on actually making auto parts and selling them at the store. Both of those, all of the things I learned from them traveled through my career. But most importantly, is this sense that if you want it, to something in any area of life, you just needed to go ahead and try to get it. You shouldn't be waiting for something magically to happen to you, for somebody to get things for you. You should have initiative, which is something that I look for in every employee that I've hired since.
You know, and it sounds like too, for you, you were really going to school, but you were working as well. And to look back on those days, I would assume that impacted you as well to the success you would go on to have.
I was lucky in many respects, yes, because I was the things I was learning in college at night, I could apply at work during the day. And I was particularly lucky that when I moved over to the broadcast station that owned a radio company, I went with two other executives from my first employer that very promptly left. So I was at 21, faced with an opportunity to essentially move and ask for a bigger role. And I asked my boss, who this amazing executive, Rogelio Pianeza, who was in his 60s, whether I could run the advertising sales team myself. And very much to my astonishment, he said yes. He probably thought, you know, the kid is, you know, deserves a chance. And so I found myself in this very unusual position of having people reporting to me who were almost all of them, me, and finding and learning how to manage. And I stayed at the company for almost 4 years. And again, he was one of the many people that really created an inflection point in my career that really helped me just through chance and through the lessons that imparted in me move along on my career.
It sounds like at that time he must have become a mentor, but the fact that you were able to ask that at such a young age, where did that come from internally? Because that's a big ask.
I felt that I had nothing to lose, and I felt that if I didn't raise my hand, and sometimes a lot of what happens to one in one's career is a matter of being at the right place at the right time. And I felt if I didn't ask, the worst that could happen is that they could say no, he could say no. And I knew that he wasn't particularly looking forward to spending a lot of time in interviewing a manager and recruiting them. So he must have also thought, well, the worst that can happen is that he doesn't do a good job for 3 months and then we'll have to replace him. But very fortunately for me, the sales came in and we were able to essentially build the team. It was also a very young company, very, very small team. The radio station had just been bought, but this much larger broadcast station. And I was also in a fortuitous, very fortunate circumstance when 4 years later, I decided that I wanted to go back to cable television. Remember, this is in the 80s, in the 90s, when cable television throughout the Americas was starting to grow and there was more and more demand. And I got recruited by a small cable channel that had just opened an office in Argentina, but they were based in Miami. And through that work, through that job, I was able to start coming to the U.S. and experience what it was to interact with American companies and the American style of doing business, even though my English was not great at all. I barely spoke any. And it just implanted in me that bug of what if one day I worked at an American company, but in the U.S.
Take me back to those days when you were coming here on business and doing a lot of work in Miami. And when you touch down and see what American business was like, was that exciting for you? Did you feel right then and there that you wanted to be part of that?
Very much so, especially given that I was 26 at the time. I had never been to the U.S. for vacation. It was just not something that my family had thought about. And we, first time I get to the U.S., I just did not know what to expect. And I come in and I find that people do what they say they're going to do. I feel that there's a meritocracy and an organization and a structure and an ambition and a culture that really celebrates entrepreneurship. This company that I was working for was a young, maybe a couple of years old company. So I felt at that time that maybe not at that moment, but down the line, an opportunity to work in the U.S. would happen. And so 6 months later, so I didn't work for this company much for a long time. Fox recruited me to run their advertising sales rep in Argentina. So I wasn't working for them directly. I was working for the company that represented their ad sales. And that's when I started to come again to Miami and LA. And a few, less than a year later, they offered me a job to move to Miami and join their advertising sales team.
And was there any hesitation at all, or were you ready to make that move?
Well, there was, because obviously my family is still in Argentina and my friends, and I had to take a pay cut in order to come to the US. But Argentina was, in that time, this is 1997, was going through a particularly strong economic boom. But I felt that this investment in my career would pay off over the years. And again, much like it would have been in the early years when I took that job as a manager, what's the worst that can happen? I could go back to Argentina if it didn't succeed. I mean, if anything, the biggest problem is that I didn't have a network and my accent was even stronger than it is today. My English in general just wasn't good at all.
Was that hard for you? Did you see that as an impediment at the time? Were you conscious of it?
For sure. To this day, I'm overly conscious about it. But my bosses, Ashley Marable in particular, told me, look, you're going to be Miami. Half the people that you speak in with speak Spanish as a first language, and you're going to integrate over the years. And so you learn what you need to learn. But also, again, he was another one of the people that really had an impact in my career. But about a year into it, I felt that I wanted to move beyond advertising sales. And I wanted to have what's so-called, what's called a P&L job, a profit and loss responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that most of the people at the organization that had P&L jobs had MBAs. And I did not have a business degree. And so I decided to go to business school, to University of Miami on the weekends, while continue to work for Fox on weekdays and make sure that people in the organization were aware that I was taking this step in order to hone in my skills and just learn about business in general. And again, very, very fortunately, 7 or so months later, an opportunity opened up that required me to move to LA to run the Fox Entertainment Channel, essentially the Latin American series and movies channel that carried The Simpsons and Family Guy, those kind of shows. And I still kept going back to Miami to finish the MBA because I felt that that was important in general. But I moved to LA then in 2000, and this is where I still live.
And you were a young guy at the time, and this opportunity, I mean, you obviously made these opportunities. You realized you wanted P&L responsibility. You needed to go get an MBA. You realized a lot of these things and you didn't sit around on the couch. You did it on the weekend. You worked. But what was that like getting that call and your first experience at Fox in Los Angeles?
It was incredibly exciting because, again, this came at a time where cable television was still in its infancy in Latin America and much outside of the US in general. And it was the first time that somebody was giving me a chance to run what was a 150 person division. So I went from managing a few people to 150 and moving into a new place that I knew was the headquarters of the entertainment world. I knew that over time, if you want to have a career in entertainment, you can probably end up in Los Angeles, New York, London. There are few places that would be better locations to be in if you want to be in that industry. And again, I started to meet people who were incredibly smart and incredibly generous with their time. And I get those, essentially that set the stage for the next 15 years that I spent over there.
Well, you did incredibly well. I know from research, correct me if I'm wrong, you grew this division and group from 100 and so employees, like you said, to over 4,000 worldwide in a short period of time. How were you able to do that? What were some of the things that you were able to implement that made you so successful at Fox?
Well, I can say that I did that. Obviously, was a team, right? As always, remember, I ran the Latin American division, then got promoted to COO in 2008 and then to CEO in 2011. But for most of that time, until he left, my boss, David Haslin, then was the CEO of Fox International Channels. Then I took over from him in 2011 when the organization was about 3,000 employees already. And I was, again, super fortunate to work under amazing business executives, people like today are running some of the premier entertainment companies. Tony Vinciquerra was running Sony. Mike Hopkins was a colleague of mine. He's now running Amazon. Peter Cherning, who started his own group, the Cherning Group. Chase Carey, Dana Walden, who's running Disney. And I learned from them how to scale businesses, how to hire, how to manage. And obviously, probably nobody had more of an impact than my direct boss, David Haslin. But one of the things that very quickly I realized when we were going from 150 employees to 200 to 500 to 1,000 is that the day only has 24 hours. You only have two hands. So your ability to do anything at scale, or even not at scale, will depend on the quality of the people that you have around you. Whether they are the people who work with you, your bosses, your peers, and then on a broader sense, your customers, there's only very little that we can do by ourselves. And one of the traps that people sometimes fall under is that when they get promoted, they feel that they should continue to do their old job plus the new job. And that's not the reason why they got promoted. They got promoted because somebody saw their talent and somebody saw that they could have an influence and an impact in the organization beyond what they can do with 24 hours.
Was that hard for you as you went up the ladder to be able to let go of the past and jump into new positions?
It wasn't hard because I happened to stumble upon books that essentially put that as the number one lesson of when you get promoted. I was a business book, still am, business book junkie. And one of the books I remember in particular on this stage was called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And it's one of the books that most managers who get promoted for the first time, 20, 30-year-old book, but essentially tells you that you should be managing, spending your time managing, addition to doing, but particularly managing. And then when you become promoted to manager of managers, you become aware that now you're recruiting people for their own ability to inspire others, to get things done, to recruit, to get people really aligned and motivated to be part of the mission of the company.
So we want to, I need to obviously talk about Wondery, which, as many of our listeners know, was just this incredible podcasting company. One of the first, you were one of the first out there. How did the idea come about? And what was it like going from this big time company to being an entrepreneur?
So that process played out very slowly. I often tell the story that I was at Fox for 18 years, but about half that time, I was a wantrepreneur, somebody who really had the dreams of being an entrepreneur, but for one reason or another, kept putting it off, postponing it. My job at Fox was great, and I was happy, and the industry was growing. But I had that bug every time that I spoke, very much like you. Like I spoke with an entrepreneur, I said, what if? And towards the end of my time at Fox, when I realized that I had been there for very long and I had this opportunity to start a new business, and I didn't know whether that opportunity would come about if I waited too much longer, I had listened to Serial, the podcast that essentially took the world by storm in 2014, and then Startup, another highly serialized narrative podcast. And I went and looked for other serialized podcasts like those and found nothing. I was very curious about why is it that nobody else has created anything close to what these two companies have created. And I realized that the companies that should have created those kind of podcasts were the radio companies. The radio companies had moved away from anything that wasn't music or talk, news, and sports. And that's because in order to appreciate one of these podcast, you need to be able to listen to them from beginning to end in a sequence. And that's not the environment for radio, but it's the environment for on-demand podcasting listening. And then it dawned on me that television had gone through a similar transition at the turn of the century when we went from episodic, close-ended shows to serialized, character-driven shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and 6 Feet Under and then Breaking Bad and The Shield and Game of Thrones eventually. And that little change, if you know about the butterfly effect, right? There's the butterfly that started that change, I believe, was the creation of TiVo was around the turn of the century, was the first time that we were able to easily watch television on demand.
Yeah.
So my thought process was, if TiVo is podcast and The Sopranos is serial, somebody could come up with FX, Showtime, AMC, everything else that followed after serial. So I wanted to be that company, and I left my post at Fox in January of 2016. Fox made a small investment. And the same month, I incorporated Wondery and I hired my first employee and off we went to the races, or so I thought.
And what was that like? Go back, that feeling of, I just left Fox, where you had an incredible career, CEO level, just superstar there. And all of a sudden, you're starting a business, big dream. And I assume it's just you and a couple of employees. What were you feeling at that time?
It's worse than that, Robert, because the whole podcast industry was worth $100 million. That's it, the whole industry. At Fox, we wouldn't even think of buying a business that wasn't itself making that kind of money, just the business itself. So a lot of people thought I was crazy, to be honest. And they were wondering what's wrong with Hernan. Why did he go into podcasting of all things that he could have done? And it was scary and it was difficult in particular to raise money, because I raised initially, in addition to that check from Fox, another $200,000, I think, from friends and family and angels. And then I went to try to raise venture capital funding, which I'd never done before. And I kept completely empty-handed. Every single conversation played out the same way. You don't have enough content of your own. This is very hard. The market is too small. And unfortunately, they were right. So it wasn't that I could fault them for not investing money. They were a lot of the things that they were saying. And remember, venture capital firms say no 90%+ of the time. So the first year was tough. I think we still were, however, fortunate that on the creative side, what we were doing at Wonder, particularly we wanted to do high-touch, highly produced, serialized shows that had a Hollywood sensibility when it came to narrative storytelling techniques and sound design. A lot of the other podcasts were coming from the public radio world and we were bringing more of the Hollywood sound to it. And the people at Apple Podcasts, again, talking about people who were really generous with their time and the promotion, in many respects, helped me get our shows noticed, and they featured us on the podcast store. So we were able to create a little bit of inertia where the podcast world that was small at the time said, all right, these guys are doing something different. Let's see what else they can do.
Facing all of that rejection, knowing you could easily go back and get a big time job at a big time entertainment company, were there moments in, let's say, that first year where you were questioning yourself, getting a lot of these rejections and thinking, I should just go back?
I can't tell you how hard it was. The first year, yes. And especially, the first month that we brought revenue in, we made $10,000 in revenue. And I remember, how big can this thing be? And I can't say that any part of me seriously considered giving up, because I was only 6 months in and everybody had told me, look, being an entrepreneur is hard. I already had employees at the time, but I was bootstrapping the company because we weren't able to raise money. And I think everything changed a year, almost a year exactly after we launched, when we had the first number one hit, a show called Hollywood and Crime. The season was the about the Black Dahlia all case. And it was told in a very, what we call emotionally immersive storytelling. The formula we found was around making listeners feel they're in the middle of the story through sound design and narrative structure and voice and use of music. So when we saw that show was our first number one, we said, all right, people want to listen to these kind of stories. People are gravitating towards true stories more than drama, which is what we've done a lot of in year one. So how can we take this sound design and this essentially style and make it bigger. And again, very fortunately, I got introduced through a friend of a friend to the people at the LA Times who had been wanted to break into the podcast world. And they had wanted to do a daily show. And we had a conversation about that story they had been working on for print about this woman in Orange County who had been swindled by a very charming, but very, at the same time, dangerous doctor, or then learned wasn't a doctor. And that story was Dirty John. And this was one of the many stories that they said they were working on. And I gravitated towards her. I said, well, that can be our first psychological thriller podcast. We went on to create it together. Again, we got a lot of help from the LA Times on the marketing side and from the Apple Podcast team on the editorial, on the promotional side. And we launched the show in October of 2017. I think we had expected that we would make 500,000 downloads an episode, and it blew past 2 million downloads an episode. Wow. And it was the first show of ours that hit the zeitgeist, and people were talking about it. And that show then allowed us to walk into every room, whether it's an advertiser or a venture capital firm, and say, we are the company that created Dirty John. And that one of those meetings included Greycroft, the venture capital firm that through Alan Patrick of led our Series A, and really, again, another person that had a huge influence in positive influence in my career.
More from our guest. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Think about a bicycle. It takes balance to get where you want to go. Now, think about business. Whatever your business or organization, you ride the line between numbers and people, just like the bike. It takes balance. CLA, CPAs, consultants, and wealth advisors. That's CLA. We'll get you there. Clifton Larson Allen LLP investment advisory services are offered through Clifton Larson Allen Wealth Advisors LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.
And our next sponsor.
Whether you need digital tools so you can bank on the go, or you need a one-on-one with an experienced business banker, with PNC Bank, you got it. PNC's business banking team is built entirely around the way you like to do business. Innovative mobile tools that let you manage your cash flow, monitor your payments, and more around the clock. Give you the flexibility that every business owner needs. And PNC combines those digital tools with a team of business bankers who are ready to sit down and talk about the unique needs of your business and help you develop personalized strategies to move your business forward. Learn how PNC Bank can make a difference for you and your business at pnc.com/bankyourway. PNC Bank, National Association member, FDIC.
And we're back. At that time when that show hit, how did that make you feel like I'm on to something? We're successful? What was your feelings even at that time?
It was definitely the feeling that we have arrived at a first step, at a place where from that point on, it was going to be the idea, the vision of essentially turning Wandry into the premier brand for emotionally immersive storytelling was achievable. It wasn't that we were out of the woods. It wasn't that we had to, that everything would be easy breezy from the moment, but I knew that we arrived at a step that would make subsequent steps go more easily, including because of that Series A, I was very fortunate to be able to recruit two very key members of the Wandry team, Jen Sargent, who joined us, my COO, and she's now the CEO of Wandry, and Marshall Louis, my chief content officer, who's still with them at the Amazon organization.
Yeah, it's kind of nice to see that. I'm sure you're a mentor to them, and now them running the business must make you feel pretty good. And, you know, it's interesting because you had kind of the formula for the product, but you still then were able to, which is one of the hardest things in business, quickly scale. How were you able to do that? What was your strategy?
I think it was very important for us to to be methodical about release schedules and making sure that we launch enough of this, enough shows in a certain period of time. And again, I was bringing to Wondery things that everybody in the Hollywood world knows. For instance, I learned from the team at FX many years ago that even if you make a show that is amazing, you still need to promote it with a marketing budget that sometimes can be comparable to the production budget of the show. And that's something that, again, Peter Liguori at FX discovered maybe 20 plus years ago. And the podcast world was not really known. And it was a little anathema to most people think you should put all your money in production and then nothing, and the show would sell itself. That, again, a true misconception in many companies. The reality is that if your product is great, you'll still get a lot of benefit from having a significant promotional campaign because more people will listen, watch it, experience it. And we also noticed that in the world of short miniseries, or the miniseries we're making were 6 episodes to maybe 8, there will be an influx of listeners, and then those listeners will leave unless they had something else to listen to that we were promoting to them. So that was the second big insight in the Wondery scaling story, how we were able to combine both those short series released within successive close enough periods of time with ongoing shows that we have, like Business Wars and American History Tellers and even The Rich, that were on 50 weeks a year, if that makes sense. So I think part of it was essentially building the brand. And also the other thing that we were very intentional about was creating sound design that was indistinguishable, that was very unique and immediately distinguishable. The very same way that when people go and watch a Pixar or a Marvel movie, they know immediately that it's Marvel or Pixar without even seeing the opening. And that's something that we wanted to create from the sound icon, the Sonic logo that Wondery has at the beginning of every show, to just the style of the narration and the storytelling.
You scaled up really quickly, built an incredible name, put out fantastic podcast series, and a lot of folks came knocking at the door, and you ended up deciding to sell the business for a lot of money. Tell us about that process and what your thoughts were when that opportunity came.
To the extent that I can speak, obviously, because there are commitments and what makes about what we can and cannot say, but I knew from the beginning that every time that you take venture capital money, you are going to need an exit. And the exit is either you sell to another company or you go public or you merge. But really, that's not a preferred outcome for most VCs. And I sense that that was going to be difficult for Wondery to become a public company, given the total size of the marketplace. So early on, I had imagined that the most likely outcome would be an acquisition. But when we raised our Series B round in 2019, I knew that that meant that we needed to grow the company to a minimum of X before we could even entertain the conversation. And then 2020 happened. So the pandemic changes the dynamics of listening patterns and obviously how advertisers are designed to spend their money. And by the time we already started to diversify by launching television shows or actually optioning television shows, we had a first look deal with Apple TV that had just been signed. We had an output agreement with Audible as well. And we were about to launch our subscription service, Wondery Plus, and Liontree, who informally had helped me raise the Series A, great, again, amazing person, Alex Michael.
Hello, Alex.
Who you probably know
yes.
in the summer of 2020, and said, Hernan, we're getting phone calls all the time asking whether you're interested. And I said, well, I mean, we talked about that. The timing is not now, because our investors are going to want a certain set of considerations for the exit. And another factor was that my employees, all of them were option holders and shareholders. So directly or indirectly, we had hundreds of shareholders in Wondery. But to the credit, Liontree went and made a couple of phone calls, and we had a few presentations, and then Amazon came in with really an offer that, from the point of view of what I knew what they could do for the company going forward, was undeniably a compelling offer. Two things that were important to me was Wondery going to be able to have a great home in the business that acquired it, and B, how equally important, how successful the team was going to be. And it was immediately apparent that Amazon was the right exit for the company and the right solution for the employees. And if you see now what they've done over the last 2 years, I am incredibly proud of the work that my team has done under Amazon and how Amazon has helped them achieve that success.
Yeah, I love you brought up Alex and Liontree and the incredible job they've done. And funny enough, Alex had helped me before he actually, just as a friend, sell my business or just give me tips, much smaller business when we sold to Creative Artists Agency. And I was just like, this guy is super bright, right? Super sharp. And he's done extremely well as they have. But when you do look back on Wondery and the business you built, what are some of your proudest moments and achievements that, you know, now we'll get to your new business, but you look back on and really appreciate?
I'm proudest of a number of things. One of them being the culture that we were able to build at Wondery, which was very intentional, built through every interview that we did. We talked about the values and the behaviors and skills. I was always, like any person in the creative community, extremely pleased when I ran into somebody wearing the Wondery t-shirt and said, oh my God, I love Wondery. I listen to The Shrink Next Door or to Recrash or to any one of the shows that we made. But I think one particularly proud achievement, because it was difficult, was the creation of the Podcast Academy. I realized towards the end of 2019 that the podcast industry, given that it was young, didn't have a trade association, didn't have a union, didn't have a creative organization that gave out awards recognizing the best achievements. So I called a number of colleagues in the industry, both independents like Donald Albright from Up and Vanish and Tenderfoot, to Kerry Hoffman from PRX, from people from Stitcher and Sony Music. And we very quickly put together an organization that set out to give the AMBYs, that since then most people refer to as the Oscars for podcasts. And again, from very early on, we decided that the organization would have a large board of governors, a significant number of them would be independent, more than half were women, 40% people of color. And we set out to essentially create the show that we gave the first AMBYs in 2021. And today, as it happens, I sat on the committee meeting that is planning the AMBYs for 2023. So I think that sometimes when you're in a position of privilege in many respects, you have to find a way to give back. And that was very important for the podcast industry, just to be able to celebrate the voices of people who didn't necessarily have a big company behind them, as some of us did.
Yeah, that's so great. And obviously, being in the space now and understanding the Academy, and, you know, I was recently at the Podcast Movement Conference, which has grown over the years, and there were a lot of people there. And I know there's a lot of people who are saying, what's Hernan up to next? And I want to get into what you're doing now and the business you're building, and if you can give us a little bit of insight into what you've been up to.
Very much so. And you're seeing it behind me. This is our product. So about a year ago, I started with my co-founder, Jeannie Anderson, who comes from Saatchi Art, a company called Danvas. And Danvas is setting out to create our first product to display in the highest possible quality digital art in the way that the artists envision. What you see behind me are 3 displays with some art that we're going to premiere, although by the time this episode posts, probably will have premiered at the Armory Show in New York, at the Javits Center. This is by an artist called Jason Ting. This is by an artist called Luna Ikura, and this one by Helena Sarin. But I'll give you the surprise moment. Most people, how big do you think these displays are?
A couple feet, maybe.
All right. You will be surprised.
Hernan's getting, oh my gosh, they're huge.
So this is a 4x4 display. And one of the ideas that Gina and I wanted to solve was that Digital artists have been around for decades, but they were never able to fully monetize their art because nobody knew how to value a file. Nobody knew how to value something that could easily be copied. So NFTs and the blockchain solved that problem, but the problem of how to enjoy it and how to display it in real life still remain. And that's a problem that we're coming to solve. So you can, if you are a private collector of art, you can get a Danvas CRG. This is our first product, and obviously it's priced to be the Tesla of displays. I know I'm being a little cheeky, but the idea is that you could have one of these displays next to a painting, and you can have as much digital art as you would like, and you can create a playlist and be able to see what other people are seeing as well, and be able to authenticate that you actually own the art that is playing on your screen as opposed to just viewing it without necessarily owning it.
And what's that been like for you, you know, after being an entrepreneur, building up a business? How's it feel to go jump back in?
It feels great, I have to say. You know, when you have one of those opportunities that you feel that if you don't do it, somebody else will. I think that's one good test for would-be entrepreneurs. It was, in many respects, easier this time around because when I went to all of the Wonder investors, Greg Croft, Larry Hippo, Waverly, BDMI, they all said yes on the spot.
Yeah, it's a lot easier.
It's a lot easier when you're a second-time entrepreneur and you know they had a good exit with the first one. But at the same time, we launched this company through the pandemic. We're making displays. Hardware is hard to do, hard to make. But again, we are very fortunate that we partner with an incredibly talented ID firm called Ammunition Group. They're out of San Francisco. They're best known for creating Beats by Dr. Dre and Square. And our first engineer comes from Beats as well, David John and Sergey Teibel, head of software, work with Genie at Saatchi Art. So together, we're essentially creating a company that wants to really celebrate digital art and put digital art at the same level as art period. I think over the years, it will all be called art, whereas digital, physical, generative, programmatic, AI. And we think we're at one very fascinating inflection point of what we call a digital art renaissance. It's very, very, very exciting to be part of this moment.
You know, Hernan, it's amazing. And I am sure you will be successful in this respect. And if you were to give advice, there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast who are like you, you know, back at Fox and, you know, always thinking about taking the jump, looking for the right idea and stuck in it, unlike you who went for it. And, you know, there's other entrepreneurs just starting out and it's difficult. They see you and they think, oh, it's so easy. It's, you know, you're going to be selling your company for hundreds of millions of dollars. But if you were to give advice right now to any entrepreneurs out there, especially at this time, what would you say to them?
It's a broad question, but I would start with starting a business that solves a problem that you're passionate about. And I put it in this other way before. Do something that excites you so much that you would do it for free. Because guess what? For the first couple of years, you probably will be working for free. And it will show whenever you're talking to your potential customers, to your employees, to the people that you have to recruit. Again, remember, you only have two hands. You will need to attract people that share the same passion, the same enthusiasm for your problem, the solution the problem that you're trying to solve. So you need to see that in them as well. And another advice that I got, not everybody has the same luxury, is get a great co-founder. At Wondery, because I was going very quickly from working at Fox to starting Wondery, I did not have a co-founder, and I wish I had. Dan was very quickly, I knew I wasn't going to start the company without an amazing co-founder. And in Ginny, I found a perfect co-founder. She spent the last 4 years as general manager of Saatchi Art, but before that, she worked in several other marketplaces and tech companies. And she understands art, she understands product, she understands marketing, and she's just an amazing leader and a pleasure to work with.
Well, Hernan, I wish you the best of luck. I don't think you will need it. I love what you're doing with Danvas and the NFTs and the art and our listeners will be able to see it on the clips. They look incredible. And I just want to thank you for sharing your wisdom and your story and coming on How Success Happens.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Hernan.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.